ask the question, what makes wisdom wise? We saw in the book of Proverbs that we're pointed to lots of guidance on navigating life, powerful, inspired guidance on navigating life. But most importantly, we're pointed to the fear of God as the beginning of wisdom. So wisdom is wise in that it is rooted in God's character. It's not just that it makes things go well for us, but that it's rooted in who God is. Today I want to bring us to another book about wisdom, and that's the book of Job. It's a book that forces us to consider wisdom from another angle, when the world isn't working like it's supposed to, when the world is unfair. Go ahead and start with Job chapter 1, and we'll just look at verses 2 through 3. Job, you'll find, has a good life, a great life. Job chapter 1, verse 2. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. He's living the good life. I don't measure my wealth the same way. I don't have any sheep or oxen. But that obviously, in the time, is the point is, as it ends up saying, is he was the greatest in the whole region. And that's the point. And he has a large and prosperous family along with that. Job is enjoying the world God made, and he's got an abundance of that. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying and having a good life like that. God is good. God made the world. He made it good. Very good. In fact, that's the words that God used to describe his creation and his creation of us when he made it. It's good. Very good. And it shouldn't bother us, in particular, with Job, that he's able to enjoy all this good in life, because Job was good. Very good. So the first thing we learn about Job, before we learn about his wealth in verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. So he's not just living the good life, but he's living the good life. He's good. He's very good. And as we saw in our look at wisdom in Proverbs, it makes sense that living a righteous life would produce a good life. God made the world, and the world, when it works the way it's supposed to, as God created it, living with wisdom, living with God's wisdom, is going to be in harmony with that world. So it makes sense. And it's just that good things are happening for Job. But, of course, you don't know Job for that. That's not the story. It's just beginning. And it begins looking great. But then we learn about Satan entering the picture, just like the very beginning. The accuser. And he poses a challenge to the Lord. Let's read verses 6 through 12. We're going to be surveying the whole book, and so I'm obviously going to be just sampling sections, but we'll get the setting here down. And though I am going to survey the whole book, I do encourage you to go back at some point and make a point of making sure you read through the book of Job. It's just a beautiful book. It has a wonderful message. And now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, angelic beings, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless man, an upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So, God points Job out to Satan. Satan, to paraphrase, is saying, Hey, you really think Job loves you? I mean, he's got everything. You take away those blessings, and you find that it's really just the things that he loved and not you. And he'll curse you to your face. And perhaps, surprisingly to us, God lets Satan bring suffering into Job's life. And you might be asking at this point, why? And that is the question that will kind of loom over things for the whole book. And it looms over our lives. Why does God let Satan do these things? A servant reports a raid on Job's oxen and servants. They're gone. A servant reports a fire has burned up sheep and more servants. Some kind of natural disaster, or even perhaps some kind of miraculous disaster. Again, a servant reports that Chaldeans have come and taken the camels. All the livestock that were listed are obliterated, and his servants. And then a fourth servant reports not the loss of livestock or even servants, but of his own sons and daughters. They're not just leaving stuff, but his own dear family. And so Job, we come back to him in verse 20 of chapter 1. And Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Job was devastated, of course, and yet he did not hold it against God. And this shows us something right off the bat. Satan was wrong. He was wrong. Whether people bless or curse God does not depend on simple logic of whether or not life is going well for them. Sure, that's true for a lot of people, but that is, it's not so simple as that. What's amazing about Job is that while he had all this stuff, what we learn, contrary to, I think, what Satan implied, is that he saw this stuff as a gift. The Lord gave. The Lord has every right to take it away. And so he blesses the giver, not just depending on the gift. He blesses God even though his life is cursed. Is that true for us? Or is it simple math for us? Think about times when you are most tested and suffer the most. When you look at your life in times of sin, does it correlate with times of suffering? For Job, it does not here. Well, Satan is back for round two in chapter two, and Satan, he's been proven wrong. Job passed the test, and the idea that people can love God even when things are hard, it's been shown. But Satan moves the goalposts. The claim now is that if God hurts Job more directly, his own body, then Job would curse God to his face. And God, for some reason, allows that. Chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, and he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. And his wife said to him, Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. In light of everything that's happened, I think that would have been the breaking point, if nothing else was earlier, for me. The only family he has left, his own wife, is encouraging him to do everything that Satan says that he would do. It's such a harsh thing, such a blasphemous thing, that in the preserved text that we have of Job, it doesn't actually say curse. It says bless. because the Jews would use the word bless as a euphemism for curse sometimes. It was too blasphemous to even pen. She says, what she means really is curse God and die. And yet, Satan has proved wrong again, in verse 10. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive disaster? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So the same thing as chapter 1 ending. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. He's not blaming God here. He's not cursing God. And though this issue of how will Job respond to his suffering still hangs in the balance for the rest of the book, and we're thinking about it for the rest of the book, it's a long book, I think the main issue is settled. That when Satan hit him the hardest, he held on to understanding that God is gracious and good and not cursing God. And then we learn that he's got some friends who come and learning about this calamity, suffering and grief, and they come and they weep with him. And for 7 days, they are excellent friends in time of grief. The eldest are there with him, silent. But that's it. For 7 days, they're excellent friends in grief. Then Job speaks. And that's what we have in chapter 3. And it's not just the telling of the facts of a story. It is very poetically written. I don't think that they were just spouting poetry, I can't get the right word out of my mind here, but just off the bat, I think that's written to us and recorded in a way that is very poetic. So it's beautiful to read, is what I'm saying. It's long, and it can, you know, be patient in some ways to get through it, but it is beautiful. So don't just think, oh, well, chapter 3, here's what he says, move on. I, again, encourage you to read it, because it'll make a greater impression on you. But basically, he does say, I wish I was never born. That's what it basically amounts to. In very vivid language. And this is the point in which his three friends, they can't quite take it. I feel like I relate to this in a bad way. But I can patiently sit there while you grieve, but now you've said something that isn't quite right. And I think, in a way, it wasn't quite right for Job to say. But sometimes we say things that aren't quite right in expressing our grief. In fact, in the words of Eliphaz in chapter 4, verse 2, he says, who can keep from speaking? To introduce his rationale for speaking up. And, of course, the implication is, well, not Eliphaz. Cannot, when he needed to, still keep from speaking. And it turns out, these aren't just friends that Job has. That in this time of grief, that Job learns that he's got philosophizing friends. We might find that we all have philosophers and psychologist friends when we're in times of grief. What you find as you read through the main body of this beautiful book is that his friends, while saying lots of different things, the main thrust of what they have to say is to connect Job's suffering to his sin. And they're presenting themselves as wise. As the wise philosophers they are, this is what they have to say to their friend who feels like life is not fair right now. The answer is, well, this God's just, and our suffering is always connected to our sin. So, the implication is, Job, you should humble yourself. You need to confess your sin, things like that. And that's the way the book goes, is Eliphaz talks, Job responds, Bildad speaks, Job responds, Zophar philosophizes, Job responds, and then again, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and a third time Eliphaz, Bildad. Well, you expect Zophar, but apparently Job has had enough, and Zophar doesn't get his third time. Perhaps they're all running out of steam. The speeches get slower as you go, or shorter, I should say, as you go. I haven't done a thorough study of Job this time through. I've done more than I had before, but I haven't analyzed each individual section super closely yet. But I think 4:8, chapter 4, verse 8, here at the beginning of what they have to say is a fair summary of that main point that they're making. As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. Your friend has lost everything. And because he said something that wasn't quite right, and maybe even makes God look bad, about life being unfair, well, the way I see it, you see what he's saying, right? You reap what you sow. What goes around comes around. You could find this wisdom in the Proverbs, because it is wisdom. It is a proverb. Proverbs 22:8, not verbatim, but the same basic principle: whoever sows injustice will reap calamity. And it's not just an obscure reference in Job or in Proverbs. It's what a lot of the Proverbs have to say in different words. And it's a proverb for us today. We say this kind of thing all the time in different terms. And it's useful. And it's helpful, but as we said with the Proverbs, it takes wisdom to apply the Proverbs. We don't force them. Their nature is not to force them into every individual situation. And so they've got the Proverbs intellectually, but they don't have the wisdom to apply it to their friend in grief. That things go well for those who do well, as a basic principle in life, doesn't mean that always happens. And so that things end well isn't the primary factor in discerning whether it is good or wise. We talked about some of that with the book of Proverbs itself. And so Job, what you find in his responses throughout, is that he does continue to insist on his innocence. They are implying that he's done something wrong. That's part of why he suffers. And he keeps saying things like, if I've sinned. We don't have this overpouring of, you're right, guys, here's all the wrong that I've done. He keeps saying, if I've sinned, you know, show me, that kind of thing. Chapter 7, verse 20, chapter 10, verse 14 were ones that I noted. And after all his friends have to say, when you get to chapter 27, you've gone through those three cycles of his friends speaking to him. In chapter 27, verse 6, he says, you can read a larger section where he's saying this in multiple ways, but he says, I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. It reminds me of Paul on trial. I had lived in good conscience. He's saying, Job doesn't think he's completely sinless. I think that bears out when you read it. But the idea that the devastation he's faced is a simple cause and effect from his sin to the situation he's in, it doesn't compute for Job. And so Job ends up crying out to the Lord in chapter 30. I know we made our way right across the book here. Job 30, verses 19 through 23, he turns to God. He said, all this wisdom from his friends, they've fallen short, so he turns to God. God has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. I cry to you for help, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you only look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm, for I know that you will bring me to death. into the house appointed for all living. Kind of comes back around to what he said before any of his friends have spoken. This is just unfair. God has been cruel to me and persecuted me. Do you see why that's hard for them to just listen to without trying to tweak it? And again, I think that that's true for Christians that I've known in grief, that they say things. I've said things that, whoa, that's not quite right. And I want to just be like Joe's friends. But we got to be careful as you read through Job or you hear a citation from Job, because so much of it are these people talking who aren't people, who are saying things exactly right. So you can't just pull it out, but like, the Bible says, well, that's someone being recorded in the Bible saying that. And they're misguided. And that's the point. Their wisdom has fallen short. And so Job just has to continue to just wonder what in the world God is doing and how God can do this to him. And I do think that though Job does not, his sin has not caused his suffering, and though we can be understanding for the things that he does say that, that bother his friends, that I do think we also can still recognize that he does border on irreverence sometimes. I think you can find that in the Psalms as well. Sometimes it does seem like a line may be crossed. Calling God cruel just feels like it's going too far. Even while being understanding of that. Then out of nowhere, another friend speaks up that we didn't know was there until we get to this point. Elihu. And I want to read just a little bit of what he says in chapter 32, verses 1 through 5. I want to read it because it kind of helps us nail down what we've already, what's happened up to this point. So much of the book is poetry and hard sometimes to understand and follow, but this is written in pretty direct ways to summarize where we've been so far. So chapter 32, verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. When Elihu saw there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, he burned with anger. You see the solemn, careful wisdom that is guiding him. Anger is guiding him here. But it gives you a sense of where this all has been. We've been wading through all of these speeches and this long symposium here from these wannabe philosophers, and he's saying, you know, I was hoping for some wisdom for all you old guys, but I'm going to have to speak up now. And he does apparently bring some nuance to the discussion, but in the end, if I'm reading him correctly, I think he's landing in the same place ultimately where the others have before him, connecting Job's suffering in a causal relationship with his sin. And he still then leaves Job without good answers, because no matter how many times you tell Job that that you must have some really dark things in your closet, he knows where he is. He knows he hasn't done the things that they've insinuated. So he still doesn't have an answer. So that's where you're left here so far. Are his friends right? Do you only ever suffer because of your sin? Especially when you suffer like that, you must really sin badly. Or is Job's implication correct, which seems to insinuate that sometimes God is unfair? As blasphemous as that is, it just looks like God is unfair. Obviously, you can see the problems with both of those, but those feel like the options. When we put ourselves in the seat of wisdom to be able to know the answers, these are the kinds of answers we're going to end up with if we're going to be able to think that we have the answers fully available to us. And what it can feel like in a book that engages the wisdom literature of the day, it can feel like what it's saying is, wisdom is of no use when the world isn't going the way it's supposed to. It can feel like that's what this book has to say. Well, what's the point? All these wise guys here, they're not offering any answers, so forget about it. Wisdom isn't true to life after all. But that's not ultimately the point of the book. Wisdom is precisely for navigating a broken world as well as a world that's going the way it's supposed to go. James tells us this, James chapter 1, James came to mind lots throughout this. I remember as a kid, one of these New Testament books pictures kind of got a library of New Testament books, and they categorized different books, and they had James as a wisdom book. And I think I resisted that for a while. You know, it's a letter, it's like others, but it does engage with the wisdom idea and theme, and is really, I think, the main theme of the book of James. So that came to mind a lot here. Job is specifically referenced at the end of the book as an example of enduring suffering. But let's read chapter 1, verse 2 here, starting. Wisdom is for, to get a point back into view, wisdom is for suffering. It's especially pertinent for suffering. So, verse 2. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. You can read that as a disjointed, random set of points, but I really think it's intentional. Count it all joy when you go through trials, and what you're going to need when you go through trials is wisdom. Real wisdom. The Christian wisdom. That's what you're going to need. So it's not like wisdom is less effective. It is especially needed in times of suffering. Then God, in the book of Job, after Elihu speaks, God enters the scene, which is something Job had asked for, demanded, and longed for, that he can have a meeting with God. And so that's what God affords him. Chapter 38, verses 1 through 4. As we hear God speak, what we want is the answers. That's what we want. Why all this suffering? What are the answers to these big questions about the nature of suffering and relationship to our sin? Chapter 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding." And he goes on, the same line of questioning, and it's, "Who do you think you are?" They've all given their thoughts about the way the world works, the way God works in this broken world, but they've put themselves in a position to be able to be fully aware of how wisdom really works and how God really works. But in the end, without providing the answers, the point is Job needs to trust God's wisdom. The thing about wisdom that we learn from Proverbs is that it's about what God you serve, right? Because God is the source of wisdom. It's grounded in his character. But it also, it means, as we're seeing in Job, is that we don't all have access perfectly to God's wisdom. Just like I'm not ever going to be have the knowledge that God has, or the power that God has. In eternity, I won't have all that. He will still be God alone. So, especially in this world, but I'd say after. God alone is wise. So then, one of the mistakes we make in trying to solve the world's problems is to assume that I can. Who do we think we are? So Job needs to humble himself in his suffering. Even as questions arise, we need to have humility. We have questions, but humility before God leaves room for answers that are inaccessible to me. That God can have his answers, even if I don't get to know them right now. Thankfully, we find that Job responds with humility. How could he not? Job 40, verse 8. There's always larger paragraphs we could read, but just verse 8 for now. God had implied that Job had crossed a line. Okay. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Well, Elihu was picking up on that. That's part of why his friends couldn't keep it in, because he did cross a line. In justifying yourself, you've made God out to be unfair, and you right. And so, chapter 42 is where we finally get Job here, repentance, the end of the book, verses 1 through 6. And we'll read these several verses together here. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak, and I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself, and repent in dust and ashes. Admitting, finally, his ignorance. And his wrongful insinuations about God's justice and purposes, he repents. In the end, we also see that God sees the others went too far as well, as God is displeased with them in verse 7. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you accordingly to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. So in the end, he hasn't cursed God. In the end, he repents in his humility and without receiving the answers. You know, God doesn't even, and many have pointed this out before, God doesn't even tell Job what we get to know, and that is that, well, here's what happened. Satan came and challenged me, and I took the challenge. And you happen to be the subject of that. Or the object of that. Job doesn't even get to know that. He doesn't get the answers. He has to be humble and have faith. In the end, of course, we do find that Job receives back all kinds of blessings, twice as much livestock as he had before, and new sons and daughters, as well as a long life. But Job needed to come to the decision he did and repent as he did without the promise of things being restored in this life. That's a lesson we need to take home. So, first, there's just three things I want to remind us of as we wrap up here. First, the book doesn't say everything there is to say about suffering, but what it does have to say is trust God in humility and look for him for the wisdom to navigate a broken world. Just trust be patient. James holds up Job as a patient man, enduring suffering. Second, do not assume that anyone suffers or any group of people suffers necessarily because of their own wrong. Sometimes it happens. I'm just saying, don't assume it. Don't assume, as his friends did, that they suffer because of wrong done. In John 9, Jesus comes upon a man born blind, and his disciples ask him, well, what happened? Did he sin? He was born blind, so maybe his parents sinned. Jesus says, he's born blind for the glory of God, that God would work through him. So maybe in God's mercy, in restoring us, is what God is doing. Or perhaps it's just to teach us to trust him without it being restored in this lifetime. And we learn from Job that when we assume that, it can be harmful. What terrible friends they've been to him. And it can be hurtful and do serious damage to people if we come to others with this assumption. I went and listened to a preacher specifically on this topic. Wasn't someone that I had previously known or respected, and that bore out in the lesson, because he was addressing the subject of systemic racism. And in order to argue that it can't be a thing, I understand that that could be debatable in our day, but in order to argue that it can't be a thing, the way he argued it is to take the assumption of Job, the book of Job, that his friends had. If you do well, things go well. So life can't be as unfair as people say it is, because God isn't unfair. And so if people have a hard life, it's because of something they've done wrong. That's the route he went with it. If you do well, things go well. So the world can't be unfair for some people. Okay, well, debate about systemic racism today. Go back to your parents' youth or your grandparents' youth and then ask, Jim Crow days. Oh, you know, well, if you do well, it'll go well. Or take it all different context. Take 400 years in Egyptian bondage, or David under Saul, or Jeremiah in Jerusalem, or Job, or Christian martyrs, or Jesus. What we're here to remember today. Christ and him crucified. Do you see the damage it doesn't just do to people, but the damage it does to the gospel when we take the assumption that Job's friends had? Sufferings because of your sin. Well, then what blasphemy does that say about Jesus? He was innocent, holy, the Son of God. And of course, the corollary, and maybe the main motivating factor for why we blame the victim in that way, is because then we can look at our own blessed situation as proof of our righteousness. We do it in all kinds of little ways. But hey, things are going well for me because I've done well. And we can point to some proverbs that will lend some support, but not to press it as we might be tempted to do. Things going well is not proof of right righteousness. So I know I spent a lot of time on that second one, but trust God and do not assume that anyone suffers because of their sin necessarily. And then finally, we never arrive at perfect wisdom. None of us becomes the arbiter of perfect wisdom. That only belongs to our Creator. And if you don't have time to read Job tomorrow or this week, I do encourage you to go back and read chapter 28. It's a beautiful passage at the center, the core of the book. And it's just saying, in beautiful terms, wisdom belongs to God. It belongs to God. And we need to remember that and have humility when we try to exercise and apply that wisdom. So finally, even though we might live a life and end in terrible suffering, it doesn't have the restoration that Job's life has. Because of Christ's atonement, the kind of Proverbs state of things, the way things are supposed to work, will ultimately be true. Eternity will be just. perfectly just. It will be true in eternity that if you do well, it will go well. That's what God is ultimately giving and promising. Because his sacrifice, because of his suffering, willingly taking on the brunt of the consequences of sin, we can be saved. And so we invite you. We invite you to enter the hope of a world where things will be made right because of the one who did suffer unjustly. And you can be baptized into Christ, be saved by his grace through faith, and know the only wise and merciful and just God.